Superior in 1977. She's the founder of Helen House, a hospice for children, and Douglas House, a place of respite care for young adults aged between 16 and 40. The BBC made a documentary series about Helen House and Douglas House, and have recently followed it up with The Children of Helen House Revisited, which you may have seen recently. She's even been on Desert Island Discs recently, so I'm sure she's known to many of you. So welcome, and thank you for coming again. We're going to start by watching at the 10-minute opening of that documentary, and then I'm going to be in conversation with Sister Frances, and then we'll open it to you to ask your own questions. So, Harry, could we have the film, please? Obviously, Sister Frances, the work that you do with the children and families is very intimate and very personal. What was it like, and what were the issues you had to discuss with everybody about opening up Helen House for a whole year first, and then for the 3 months for the follow-up?
Well, I suppose the initial reaction was, go where you nasty media people. But the fact that actually, and because we think of Helen and Douglas House as very private, safe places for the families who come to us. But then it did help that I knew the person who was going to produce the programme if they did film with us. And so what we did was we got in touch with all the families and said, how would they feel? And then we had a meeting and everything was explained about what would happen if we said yes. And they were told that they would have absolute right of veto up to the final edit. And then the brilliant thing that the BBC team, four of them, did was they were just around with no camera at all for about 3 months, sharing meals, working the odd shift, drinking endless cups of tea and coffee and other things. And by the end of that, the families were queuing up to tell their stories. They really, really wanted the world to understand how it is for them. Because as I think I mentioned on that little bit of film, it can be very lonely. You feel that people are actually, the world goes on around you and you're in this little bubble of isolation.
What you did with Helen House and Douglas House is quite pioneering work, but it feels like it's very established now and you talk all over the world about what you've done. And I wonder if looking back to when you first began, whether there are any surprises to you about how this work has developed and how the houses have grown, things that you wouldn't have perhaps envisaged at the outset.
I suppose most of the time you're intent on what's immediately in front of you and, you know, what's happening not just today, but this particular hour, and you're getting on with it. But every now and again, there's an opportunity to stand back and to look at the big picture. And I suppose the thing I find overwhelming is the network of friendship and just how it's spread to so many people and how the idea has caught on. I think there are now about 40 children's hospices in the UK and many others in different countries. I've recently been in Japan, where there are plans for two children's hospices, we hope in the near future. And that's a totally different culture, where death was absolutely not spoken of for quite a number of decades. And now just gradually, that's changing. And then I'm going to Bratislava in a couple of weeks and to Cape Town. All this is because the idea has spread. Because it's a worldwide situation. Families find themselves in the midst of the tragedy of knowing that their child or their children suffer with a life-shortening condition. And it's lonely. And there is something so simple that can be done.
Both Helen House and Douglas House were named after particular people who touched you. Would you like to tell us briefly about them?
Yes. Helen was a little girl who was 2 years old in 1978, suddenly taken ill and found to have a massive brain tumour. Her mother got in touch with me about 10 days after Helen had had emergency surgery, and Helen was deeply unconscious and remained in hospital for 6 months. And during that time, I got to know the family well. And at the end of that time, her family were told that there was no hope of recovery and there was nothing more that could be done in hospital. And they knew that if that was true, then the place she belonged was at home with them. And I continued to see quite a lot of them at home. And after a few weeks, I was so concerned about their exhaustion, not just the physical exhaustion, and there was a new baby too, but the cruelly prolonged grief, which is perhaps one of the most exhausting things any of us can experience. And so one day I plucked up courage and asked them if they would trust me enough to lend her to me sometimes. And it was from that very simple beginning, a reaction to a very real situation, that the whole idea grew. And sometime later, I approached Helen's parents and said, how would they feel about extending what had become a very special friendship with them to other very sick children, their families? Friendship being absolutely the core of the whole concept about travelling, journeying together through what is a very painful journey for those families.
And Douglas?
Douglas was a wonderful young man. He and his sister started coming to us in their early teens. They both suffered with a genetic condition, Batten's disease, which causes blindness, epilepsy, and gradual deterioration, both physical and intellectual. By the time they came to us, they were both completely blind, and they were really sparky characters. They sometimes came separately for respite care because it could be... it could be quite sort of... what's the word I want? I'm not quite sure. But it was sometimes more peaceful if they came separately. And it also meant that their parents could focus on one of them, the one left at home, while the other one came for respite. But in all, they came, I think, over 70 times, for a few days at a time, respite care. Like Helen, they belonged at home with their families, but just would come to us every now and again, in the sense that once there was the extended family who could help out, but actually the extended family in our culture has almost ceased to exist, hasn't it? And so they came all these times, huge sibling rivalry. In fact, the last words I ever remember Penelope saying was, oh, that boy. She became more and more addicted as time went on to the video of The Sound of Music, till I never, ever want to hear The Hills Are Alive or any of that again. And she had beautiful long hair, and she loved to have it piled on her head and have manicures and makeovers and so on. Whereas Dougie was into Jaws and the Beatles and going to the pub for a pint when he was old enough. And Penny died the day after her 18th birthday, but Dougie lived to be almost 25. I remember going into the playroom one day in what is a children's setting, but he didn't seem to mind. His whole idea of living was friendship. So he was sitting on the sofa, and I went and sat by him, and I said, Dougie, I've just done something so stupid. And with great difficulty, he asked me what I'd done, and I told him whatever it was. And he simply put his arms around me, gave me a big hug, and said, you're not stupid, you're my friend. And there was no doubt in my mind that the new house just across the vegetable patch from Helen House should be called after Douglas, our friend. But I was really worried about Penny because of the sibling rivalry, and I thought, wherever they are, she's going to be giving him a really hard time. And so I consulted their parents, and they came up with this wonderful idea. Could we ask the design developers to design a little extra space where the girls could have hairdos and makeovers and manicures and so on? And in pink lighting above this room, it says Penny's Parlour. So we hope she's well pleased.
Certainly in the documentary that I watched, the clips of girls having their makeovers done, they were just always so happy, big grins and laughter. And
that's right.
Something you said in the recent revisited documentary was that time has depth as well as length, and that we can go deep into the present moment. And I just thought that was wonderful, and I wondered if you could expand on that a bit more.
I think it's one of the most important things the families have taught me over the years. And I have to just say at this point, we go on learning from the families. They have so much to teach us. But this thing, and perhaps it's the small children who have the gift naturally of living in the present moment. Most of us foolish grown-ups are either living in the past a lot of the time, either with regret or nostalgia or whatever it may be, or in the future with anxiety or longing. And what we lose, actually, is the present moment. And as far as I'm concerned, God's gift to each one of us is in the present moment. And as far as these families are concerned, they know that for their child, or as with Penny and Douglas, their children, have got a limited lifespan, and therefore it's natural to want to make the very most of now. But I guess it's a lesson that all of us can learn. We don't know how long we'll be in this life. And it is God's gift to us, each present moment.
Last time you were at Greenbelt, you talked about how the rise of bereavement counselling is a good thing in itself, but there's a negative flip side, which is the rest of us who haven't had that training feel inadequate and we can't do anything. Yeah. And again, I remember very clearly you saying what's important is that you look people in the eye and you ask them how they are, and that at the end of it you'll feel worse, but they will feel better. But I just wondered, with you in your position as being somebody who's very explicitly got faith, how you deal and balance this aspect of what people must at some time say, why is this happening and how can God let this happen, with this this just sense of being with somebody?
Interestingly, those questions, in my experience, aren't usually asked by the people closest to the child who's dying or has died. It's usually just a little bit further out in the circle of people surrounding that child. Somehow, for the parents, the brothers, the sisters, there are so many other things to focus on. Maybe the questions will come later, and there are always exceptions to everything, aren't there? I have to say that all these years on, and Helen House is 27 years old now, I've got fewer answers to the big questions than I had at the outset. And I'm not afraid to say that. I think some of the trouble starts for some of the families when they feel that their Christian belief, or their, we have people of all faiths and none, that excuse me, that their belief system tells them that they ought to be thinking in a certain way, and actually in reality it doesn't work for them. And I think what I would say to them is, leave all that, it's all right, you know, you just be as you are. My experience is we haven't been told all the answers to the big questions. And as far as the team who work in Helen Douglas House, and actually any of us, I believe it's actually about being prepared to journey with that other person. And it can be a long, difficult journey. We have to be sure we're the right person and it's the right time. But it's journeying as a companion, cum panis, with bread which is symbolic of what we need for survival and for nourishment, but so basic, so ordinary, so everyday. And it's our ordinary, basic, everyday selves that can make such a difference to that other person who's having such a difficult journey. So it's about that. People say to me, what has it done to your faith? And actually, I think it's deepened my faith beyond words. But my faith is no longer very often cerebral. I can't reason with it. It's not by any means always of the heart either. I can't necessarily feel it. But I have this real sense in which it's somewhere deep, deep in me. I can't touch it. I can't reach it. But it's the very ground in which I'm planted and in which I can be nourished and grow. So I don't think we need to worry if we don't have the answers. I remember years ago a mother who, before she came to us, 2 years before she came to us, she'd had a baby girl who died in an unexplained cot death. And when she came to us, she brought her 5-year-old son with a rare genetic condition. And we knew he was very, very near the end, and in fact he died 5 days later. So we didn't have a chance to get to know that family quite as well as we do many. We kept in touch, though. I think I took his funeral, and we did home visits, and they came to see us, and we were often on the phone. And then one day, just over a year after he died, she asked to come and talk to us, and what she actually said was, there's something I need to tell you. She said, a fortnight ago, I went to my doctor, my GP, and I said, I'm depressed. And he'd looked back in her notes and he said, all this happened a long time ago. It's time you pulled yourself together. And he gave her a prescription for antidepressants and a letter of referral to a psychiatrist. And she said, the letter just confirmed in my own mind that I was going mad, because it was more than a year, and everybody kept saying to me, you should be getting back to normal now, and it was getting worse, not better. And she said, as far as the prescription was concerned, I cashed it in and I took the lot. Somebody found her in time, got her to hospital, and 2 days later she was back home with a neighbour standing there saying, you mustn't be so selfish, you've got your family to think of. And she said, you know, I know how hard it is for people, but when I go to collect the boys from school, people scatter as if I've got 2 heads or leprosy or something. She said, I know how hard it is for people, but please don't cross to the other side of the road. Please just smile at me, touch me, that would be wonderful. A hug would be just amazing. She said, I know how hard it is for people to say anything, but just to say, I'm so very sorry, I just don't know what to say, that would be brilliant. The best of all, she said, would be the neighbour who used to ring on my doorbell on the way back from shopping, or the couple who used to come in for a drink after supper. It'd be just lovely if they'd still do that. And she said, they only need to say 3 words to me, really. How are you? And if they've got 2 or 3 hours to spare, I'll tell them. And this is what you were quoting, you know, they come back next week, it'll be just as bad, all irrational and upside down. But she said, all I need is blotting paper, really. It made me think of something somebody said to me years ago. It's not for nothing that God gave us 2 ears and only 1 mouth. And she said, you know, at the end of all that, my friend will feel so much worse and I'll feel so much better. And I think that's what it's about. And my rather rude remark about bereavement counsellors, please don't think that that's a blanket judgment, because it's not. But I'm just saying it's sad that our culture has become as it has, that we've needed to do so much training to come alongside, to offer companionship, to journey with people in their grief, whether it's before or after the person they love has died. It surely should be something that comes to us naturally. What's happened, of course, is that we've de-skilled the next-door neighbour and the friend at school and the colleague at work. And I think that's something we need to focus on.
Thank you. Do you want water?
I'm fine now, thank you.
Right, I think I'd like to let you ask some questions now. I'm not sure if there's a roving mic or if people just shout up. There doesn't seem to be a roving mic appearing. So if you've got a question, if you put your hand up and then I'll point to you and then you can shout it out. Right. Any questions?
Over there. Mm.
Really shout as loud as you can.
Is it better if I talk like this?
Yes.
That's fine.
In case if anyone didn't hear up there, the question was, it takes a lot out of you to be giving in that way, and how does Sister Frances look after herself and feed herself?
Can I just ask a question back? Do you want me to speak to my particular situation or more generally about the people that work there? About me, was it? Oh dear, all right. Okay, I'll do a little bit of both if that's okay with you. I think to start with, it is about having people, having a life. You know, I'm so blessed to be part of a community. I have sisters who not only are tolerant, but are loving. And I have a base to return to. I have a wonderful circle of friends, many of them actually, who've come to Helen House in previous years or Douglas House. It's about knowing how to recharge your batteries, really, isn't it? It's also about having, for me, times of silence and of solitude when I can find that. And it's all rooted and grounded, I guess, in the walk with God. If I can just focus, you can ask me more about that if you want to, but can I just focus for 1 minute on the teams who work in both houses? When I was, in the early days, when I was involved in recruitment, this is where it starts, isn't it? What I looked for was, somebody came into the room for an interview. Is this a fully paid up card carrying member of the human race? One. Is this somebody with compassion, common sense, a good sense of humour? Are they unafraid to cry as well as to laugh? Are they a team player? Are they prepared to take risks, especially in this extraordinary culture of bureaucracy? And on a good day, I'd remember to ask what qualifications and experience they had. But it really is about looking at the whole person and trying to, of course, every now and again we make a mistake, but trying to see whether they've got a life out there, whether they've got something that they can fall back on, whatever it is, whether it's faith or good family life or interests of one kind or another, that they can sort of recharge their batteries and come back refreshed, because it's fatal if it's just work.
Thank you. Any more questions? Right, over there. We do have the mic, don't we? Thank you.
Hi, I'm a paediatric nurse and work quite a lot with children and with life-limited illnesses and their families. And the location that I'm in, we're fortunate enough to have two children's hospices which the children can use. But in recent years, there seems to be kind of an overwhelming response from the families that their respite care is being taken away from them due to kind of staff shortages and, I don't know, lack of resources by the sounds of it. And there seems to kind of, you know, for myself personally, but also many of my colleagues, this overwhelming desire to try and fill that need that seems to be far outweighing the resources that are really there. So I was just really wondering if you've got any suggestions of ways in which that need can be filled, sort of away from the actual structure of hospice care.
The need for the families who are bereaved, is that right?
It was actually for respite care, was it? The need for respite? Yeah? Yeah. Yeah, so I think the woman was saying that the provision for respite has been taken away.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Right.
And so have you got any suggestions?
Well, I think you have to... my own way to do it is to dream a dream and try to make that dream reality. But it is incredibly hard now with all the bureaucracy. I do think there's room. I mean, from day one when we started thinking about this about 30 years ago, I've always thought that in an ideal world there would be a whole spectrum of choices for families so that they could pick and choose for their particular situation at any given time in their child's illness or lifetime. Of course, it's not a perfect world, and that doesn't happen, but I think there are all sorts of ways other than building a children's hospice. I would say that. I think we've reached probably enough children's hospices, you know, there is, because of all sorts of reasons, but not least because there should be more other choices, like night sitting at home or hospice at home or one-to-one respite. I've got several friends who offer regular respite to children with disability. Maybe it's a weekend a month or something like that. And, you know, however short the time is, if the family knows that they can look forward to something, then they tell me that's what keeps them going. I'm not sure, because I couldn't hear very well the question.
Yes,
have I answered it or not?
I think so. Is that okay?
I just think you need to dream a dream and bring it to reality. And usually the best ideas start in a very small personal way, in my experience. And then maybe the idea catches on and it kind of grows way beyond anything you ever imagined, which is what's happened with us.
Thank you. Another question? Oh, down the front here, keeping you fit with the microphone.
Hello, sister. It's lovely to meet you today. I work in an adult hospice, and over the last couple of years, it's becoming increasingly difficult as a Christian to share the love of God, really, and even to the point now where we've lost our chapel. And I find myself in lots of ways trying to find different ways to talk about God without mentioning God, which is awful, really. And I was just wondering... Where your hospice stands in the secular world, are you experiencing any of that sort of political problem from outside?
We're very, very fortunate because we're a voluntary organisation. We're a registered charity. So to a large extent, we can do things our way. And we do have... We do have a chaplain who happens to be Anglican. The brilliant thing about him is he asked when he came to work with us if he could be half-time care assistant and half-time chaplain, and that works so well because he's accepted by all and sundry. There he is in his T-shirt scrubbing somebody's back or going down Cowley Road to Blockbuster with them or something, you know, and then he's also the chaplain and a lovely, lovely chaplain. Very interesting. I mean, my way to do it, and I guess this is a very personal thing, isn't it? I'm quite backward in coming forward about my own belief, but I try to be open all the time so that if anybody who comes to us makes the least sort of move towards, well, you know, what do you believe or how can this be or whatever, then I'm more than happy to share with them. Very interestingly, increasingly, Muslims are asking us to support them spiritually because the ones who've talked to me have said, you know, the leaders of our religion actually don't talk to us on that level. We can't anywhere find the spiritual comfort and strength that we need in this situation. And I've had some amazing conversations, particularly with young Muslim mothers who just probably have grown up in this country, cannot go along with the idea that it's better, you know, God... One mother said to me, they'd said to me, God has taken her because he loves her better than you can love her. And another said, you know, her mother-in-law simply said to her, it's 3 months now since he died, stop crying, you will make it bad for him in heaven. Go have another baby. And there's just, and some of them hate the wailing, you know, that the traditional way, hate it, but just quite naturally cry a lot themselves, and they're criticized for that through the months that follow. I have to say that our experience is that the second year of bereavement when your child dies is almost always worse than the first. So we're talking long, long times. And you don't ever get over the death of your child. As one father said to us recently, you know, you hope you adjust to a different kind of normal. And the joy and the balance between joy and grief changes. But just when you think you're getting it right, you lurch into, you know, profound grief again. It's a journey, you know, that nobody would choose. I think it's just by being you, basically.
Thank you. Any more? Oh, where's the mic? If you go here and then somebody over there at the back.
Do you ever get angry with God? And if so, how do you deal with that?
I kind of feel I ought to. But the honest answer is no. What I have found is that... God has many faces, yes, many, many different attributes. Like the example we're always given is it's like a diamond, isn't it? And the sun shines on one bit and then on another. And for me, for many years, the God I relate to most readily is the God of weakness, the God of failure, the God of the Garden of Gethsemane. You know, if it is your will, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. Or the God... on the cross, you know, my God, why have you forsaken me? But of course, it doesn't end there, does it? After the terrible dereliction and the emptiness for those who loved him, there was the first Easter. And I think what we live with is the fact that for many people in our world, it's a very, very long Good Friday. But I believe, without being insensitive to them, sometimes our role as Christians is to make it a very, very long Easter. We're so blessed, so blessed. But there are so many things I don't understand. And for me, praying for them is simply holding them out to God. And I don't know what to ask, but just holding them out to God because he knows. I've long since stopped praying for anything specific. And people sometimes say to me, haven't you ever had a miracle in Helen House? I think, expecting me to say, well, yes, we did have a little girl who actually got up out of her bed and ran down the corridor. And we haven't had those kind of miracles. But without being facetious, I want to say to you, we have several miracles a day. And not least in the little room, which you just had a glimpse of, you know. There's a very special little girl, well, she's not so little now, she's 18, in the little room this week. She died 2 days ago. She's been coming for about 7 years. Her brother died in Helen House about 4 years ago. And I just love her to bits. And her parents are there staying with us. And they're in and out of that little room frequently, as is the older sister. And it's kind of amazing what happens in that little room, you know. I remember years ago, a baby dying and the father going in with me a few hours later when they'd washed him and dressed him and put him in the cot and saying to me, look, he's smiling. And they'd never seen this baby smile. And then 3-4 days later, we were there and after a lot of silence, the father said, it's gone. It's empty. And here it is, you know, here is nature showing us that whatever it was that animated this tiny being actually isn't in the little shell or the chrysalis or whatever you want to call it. That's left behind. It will fade. It will go to dust. But that which animated this person has gone beyond our sight, beyond our reach, into new life. And that was a father who said he had no religious belief. But to me, the analogy of the chrysalis and the butterfly is the best symbol, if you like, of resurrection. I can't do very well with fluffy chickens and bunny rabbits and things, but a butterfly is just so symbolic.
Thank you. Over there.
Just picking up on Leah's mother in the film, who said, it's so unfair, and having a sick child is so unfair. As a mother, it is unfair when your child is sick. And I wondered if you had any tips or what you might have said to Leah's mother to help her cope with the unfairness of life when you see other young people doing what your child can't.
I don't think there are any words, really. It's this companionship thing. But to agree, yes, it is very, very unfair. I think back to a mother who, her son was ill from 3 to 18, and then he died, and he was in our little room, and they did all. And she said to me, people kept saying to us, it's so unfair. And she said, I really couldn't go along with that. He'd had such a full life, and we adored him. You know, it was complete. And 16 months later, his sister, who was 2 years older, was driving home from work one day and was involved in a head-on collision and died 4 days later. And she was also in our little room. And I remember the mother coming to the door, and I just remember hugging her. And I said, it is so unfair. And she said, yeah, this time it is. We don't understand. We don't understand. But I think somehow in all the unfairness, there are so many blessings. A father said to me years ago, I'd give anything to have him well and alive again. But, you know, his legacy is that I see through things through different eyes. I've got different values, different priorities. We've got friendships we would never have had before. Because in this sort of situation, it's a tremendous leveller. Different creeds, different class, different whatever, colour, anything. You're on the same ground. You're facing the great issues of disability, of life, of death, of life beyond death. Yeah, it I don't think there are answers, except perhaps companionship and focusing on the blessings.
Thank you. Time for one more. Oh, up there. You're going to have to shout louder if you can.
Hate bureaucracy.
He said you mentioned bureaucracy twice. Is it getting better or worse?
Well, I hope I'm among friends. Two things I'd like to say. One is, the first year that Douglas House was open, and Douglas House is for people between 16 and 40, and we invited some of our older, quote, children in their early 20s, still using Helen House, to come and talk to the design developers. And what they wanted was bigger bedrooms so they could socialise in their big electric chairs, ensuite facilities, a bigger music room with really thick walls so they could make as much loud noise as they liked. Well, they got that, but they never shut the door. A long, wide corridor so they could race in their chairs or play 10-pin bowling without having to go to the bowling alley. A bar with free drinks so they could relax in the evenings and so on. Well, they got all of that. Just put me back. Why did I digress onto that?
Bureaucracy.
Bureaucracy. The first Christmas we were open, we had a group of lads from the southwest who used to be together in a special school, but at the magic age of 19, there's no more state education. Quite often, the local authority doesn't seem to know that you exist. Even your paediatrician isn't your doctor anymore because you're not a child anymore. And it does feel, from what they say, as if you're a bit dumped and that people are waiting for you to die. Anyway, we have this group who now book two or three times a year and come all the way from the southwest to stay in Oxford with us, and they have an amazing time. And it's the night staff who have to work really hard. The day staff have it quite quiet. Anyway, the first Christmas when they were all there, we had an on-spot inspection, and we got reprimanded for putting Christmas decorations up without first doing a risk assessment. And I thought, oh dear. But we do, this is where I need friends around me, we do have a sort of scheme now. When we're inspected by anybody, we try to communicate that we've really been looking forward to their visit, and they're such a help and a support to us, and we do enjoy their friendship and, you know, all that they can offer us, and half the time they fall for it.
Thank you. Okay, well, before we wind up, I would just like to ask you what... I'm conscious that you are on the road a lot now, talking about the work, and could you tell us about what the focus of your work is right now, and also, importantly, any ways that we can help you?
I guess the focus of my work now is what it has been over the years, which is to say, I know you wouldn't, but don't let's leave it just to people in special buildings with special job descriptions and so on. It's down to us all, isn't it? You know, it is about journeying together. It's about offering to be a companion for a short or a longer time. It's about... fundamentally, it's about friendship in the true sense of the word. And one of the images I constantly have is that just as the companions on the road from Jerusalem to Emmaus were joined by another who was a stranger, so if we journey with another, there is a third who joins us. It's not two, it's three. And I just think that's pretty powerful. I would want to say, let's focus on the little things. And that's why the starfish is the logo of Douglas House. It was told to me, the story, by a wonderful friend. He described himself as an unorthodox Orthodox Jew. And he was a very eminent paediatrician who tragically died in circumstances there isn't time to tell you about now. But with all good Jews, they have a story for everything, don't they? And he was the first person who told me the starfish story, which I'm sure you know. Two men walking along the beach at dawn, and every now and again, the young man bends down, picks up one of the hundreds and thousands of starfish that are washed up on the beach, and throws it back into the sea. And eventually the old man says to him, "There are so many of them. When the sun is hot at noon, they'll die. Why do you bother? what difference can you make? And the young man looks at the starfish now in his hand, and as he throws it back into the ocean, he says, it'll make a difference to this one. And I do believe that that is our Christian calling. When Jesus was incarnate, he moved around among so few people in such a tiny part of our world. If I were God, I'd have done it differently. I'd have waited for jet travel and the mass media and all that stuff. But he didn't. And I just hold on to that and think each of us can make a difference in our world. And I think that's the focus of what I'm trying to say. It's not about some huge organization. Okay, our organization's expanded, but that's sort of beside the point. It's about believing that you are the right person in the right place at the right time, and God will use you just exactly where you are and move you on if you're listening and waiting when it's the right time to move on.
Great. Thank you, Sister Frances. Thank you for coming again and for moving and inspiring us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.